Next case this morning, Volkman v. Riker.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Welch. My name is John Baker, and I represent the appellant, Dwayne Volkman. Before I get into the meat of my argument, I need to clarify an inaccurate statement that I made in my briefs to this court, for which I do apologize. In my briefs, I had indicated that at a hearing on whether there was going to be a bifurcation granted, I think in my brief I said I opposed that motion. I did not. And looking back over the transcript, which we received subsequently, I did not. I stipulated to that. What I did say, though, and the transcript bears this out on page 99, was that if there are facts in contention, if the district court has to weigh facts in order to make its assessment on whether the interests of the state in suppressing speech outweigh the interests of my client in making that speech, that those facts should be presented to the jury in the form of special interrogatories. And that was on page 99 of the transcript from the hearing. This case reaches this court in a somewhat strange procedural posture. It's a First Amendment retaliation claim, and it's not here after summary judgment, and it's not here on a directed verdict. It's not here on a post-trial motion. In this particular case, we survived summary judgment. The court found that there were issues on the question of causation that needed to be resolved by a jury, and concluded, at least for the purposes of summary judgment, Mr. Volkman's speech was entitled to constitutional protection. The court then had a separate evidentiary hearing where the purpose was to determine, I suppose, whether Mr. Volkman's speech was actually entitled to constitutional protection. That is, of course, a question of law to be decided by the court. Our view before the court, and I think here today as well, was that if there are disputes of fact on the balancing test, that those disputes should be presented to a jury for a jury's resolution, then the court can apply the appropriate legal standard. The court, and it's not exactly clear procedurally how the court jettisoned the case. There's no rule of civil procedure that is cited to support the judgment that was entered. I think that the legal analysis is the speech was not protected, therefore the case is going to be dismissed. However, there's no procedural vehicle that has been cited by the court. I think regardless, there's a de novo review. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the actual speech that is in question here, and I think it's very important. And in her opinion, Judge Myerscough went through and explained, I think, exactly what happened with what Mr. Volkman said. A co-worker of Mr. Volkman, a man who he, if you saw him, you knew who he was, but he wasn't friends with him.
Wasn't he a union officer?
The one who was the union officer was a man named Chad Ray. And Chad Ray was not the one who was prosecuted. Chad Ray was...
They're sitting at lunch or someplace, and somebody, I thought it was the union rep, maybe had some authority like that, and suggested that they call the prosecutor.
And you're correct, Judge Mannion. That was a man named Chad Ray made that suggestion, and he was a union official.
Mm-hmm.
He made that suggestion. The person who had been prosecuted, however, I don't believe was a union official.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you're talking about the person that brought the phone in, used it a lot, and all that sort of
yes,
thing.
Yes, 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 Judge Mannion. But what happened here was a man had been charged with a crime of carrying an electronic device into a penal institution, which is a violation of Illinois law.
Was there more to it? There were 20-some calls. Was there some indication that he allowed or somehow inmates were permitted to utilize that phone? Is there any indication in the record, is what I'm saying?
There's nothing in the record, Judge Kaney. we don't know. And from our perspective, it's irrelevant. Because the question is whether the speech was constitutionally protected. And I think what the speech was, and when you look at it, very clearly, what Mr. Volkman said was to the prosecutor, I don't know that I understand the facts, okay? But if the facts are as I understand them to be, I understand that he brought the phone in. And if that's all that happened, I think that you should allow the disciplinary process at DOC to play itself out. However, if he allowed inmates to use them or if he used it improperly, then you should go ahead and prosecute him. That was the statement that was said, which, you know, this cuts to the very heart of the First Amendment. It's our right as citizens to contact and to speak with our elected officials. That's really what the First Amendment is all about.
So that's the expression is a matter of public concern. He was speaking to an official outside the context, I guess, of his involvement. I assume he's saying that this is bad for prison discipline and bad for prison control and all sorts of things for the prosecutor to intervene. Is that?
I don't think he even was saying that.
What was his matter of public concern when he made the call?
Well, I think the matter of public concern is the fact that there's a prosecution, which is a very public proceeding, and he is saying, I don't believe, if I understand the facts correctly, that you should prosecute this individual. I believe that he is speaking on the matter of public concern, the public concern being the official action that's being taken by the prosecutor. That is what I believe to be the...
Was that concern that he's interfering with the way to run a prison or something? What's outside his own feeling? I mean, he admits he accidentally, a time or two, carried the phone in.
Yeah. I think that he believed that it was a bad precedent to establish. I think he believed that, you know, if an officer just mistakenly brings a phone into a penal institution, that they shouldn't be prosecuted for a felony. But he made it very clear in his conversation. But if it was more than that, if it was improper, if they gave it to an inmate, then yes, they should be prosecuted. And I think when you look through the transcript and some of the depositions, you know, it's fairly clear that this was something that happened on occasion. And Mr. Volkman, when he spoke to the prosecutor, he didn't have a full understanding of the facts surrounding the prosecution. He clearly didn't. But he made that very clear to the prosecutor in what he said.
I'm not sure what difference that makes in the legal analysis here. The difficulty presented in this case comes in at the Pickering balancing phase. The district court held that this was speech on a matter of public concern coming from your client in his status as a citizen, not a prison guard. But then she did the Pickering balancing and said the prison's interests outweigh your client's interest in engaging in this speech here because of the need for prison discipline and not having prison employees injecting themselves into cases that are referred for prosecution coming out of the prison. What's wrong with that balance that she struck?
Well, I think there are a number of things wrong with the balance. First off, I believe that when we analyze First Amendment cases there on the Pickering balancing, there is a sliding scale where we look at the value of the speech and then we have to look at the value or the costs associated with that speech to the employer. Now, I think, I would hope everyone would agree that public speech, when you're speaking to an elected official, that's a fairly high rung.
As a general matter, we have to bring it down to the specifics of this case. And what we've got is a prison guard injecting himself into a case that's been referred to the local state's attorney's office for prosecution coming out of the prison. And the prison has a strong interest in maintaining discipline and deciding, you know, which cases get referred to prosecution without being second-guessed by their, you know, the prison authorities being second-guessed by lower-level employees who don't know what they're talking about, like your client who didn't know the facts. And, I'm not sure addressing the
right.
Core factual balancing or fact the balancing in the context of the facts of this case. Yes, we can all agree that mom and apple pie are good. Speech about matters of public concern are high value. things.
Well, I appreciate the clarification, Judge Sykes, and here's what I would say. There was no interest in prohibiting this speech. There's zero, zilch, none. All right? This was a situation where there was no risk here. This individual who was involved in this was fired. All right? This was not my client saying, I think this is a bad law. I don't think anybody should be prosecuted. That's not what he was saying. He wasn't undermining the operations of the department. And in all due respect, the fact that an employee takes a position adverse to that of their employer is not terribly unique. In the state of Illinois, we have all sorts of issues with the Department of Corrections that filter into our legislature. We have the Department of Corrections who says we need to close prisons, and we think that this is a good idea. They cite safety reasons. They cite all sorts of justifications. Well, then you have Department of Corrections employees who protest those decisions, who say those decisions are wrong. Well, that speech needs to be protected. They're taking a position that is clearly adverse to what their employer's position is, to the department's position. They're making that statement to their legislators or going to their legislators' offices.
Yeah, right, but this is qualitatively different than prison employees objecting to pending legislation and taking a position on it collectively or individually with the state legislature as a whole or with their individual legislators. This is a discrete prosecution of a coworker. And isn't that bound to be more disruptive of the good order of the prison? Well, than the kind of hypotheticals that you're talking about?
Well, Judge Sykes, I don't believe so. And there's certain.
It is different.
Well, yes. I mean, every fact pattern is distinguishable, and certainly that's the case here. I fully agree with. But I don't believe that there's anything that would indicate that this was disruptive to the workplace. And what I would suggest is this. The burden of proof on the disruption falls with the employer and not with the employee. Okay? And in this case, the whole reason for the burden-shifting balance in the first place is because it allows an employer, in theory, to sit there and weigh the different factors and say, is this the type of speech that we should go after, or is this the type of speech that is protected, so that they have some guidance for doing that. In this case, they never analyzed it like that because they claimed that the speech had nothing to do with his discipline. They claim they didn't even know about the speech at the time that they disciplined him. Now, that's a fact question that Judge Myerscough has said is reserved for a jury, but they want the benefit of the balancing test. They want to establish that they're successful in the balancing test, but yet that was never something that entered into their thought process at the time. You know, the balancing process is there so that an employer can, if the circumstances allow, justify their decision. The burden is on them. All they have said is they have made generalized statements that, well, there's security in an institution. This could create problems. It didn't create any problems. There's no evidence that anyone ever knew about it. It didn't change the current state's attorney's position on what he was going to do. There's nothing negative that came out of it. So what you're trying to do here is, or what these defendants are trying to do here, is they are trying to restrict the rights of a governmental employee to engage in the exact type of speech that every other person in the United States, well, not everyone, but a lot of people in the United States engage in, contacting their elected officials. And, you know, Lawrence County, where this case took place, is a very small county. It's not uncommon for prosecutors in small counties to be contacted by citizens about a matter that they are deciding or
sure
that they are prosecuting.
If there's some problem that they have, some criminal issue or some crime or some report, something is going on, there's a drug house over there or something like that, I think this is a close question, but it does seem that this contact is mostly a reflection on the operation of the prison and how it affects the guards.
Well, and Judge Mannion, I believe you're correct. However, I don't believe that that's necessarily a dispositive factor. And to support that, I would go all the way back to Pickering, because let's take a look at what Pickering actually did and what Mr. Pickering actually said. He wrote a letter where he outlined his concerns about the way the school district was spending money. All right? That was purely related to his employment. Purely related to his employment. All right? You can't divorce the two. He made the statements because he had some knowledge of what was going on.
Yeah, all right. They always refer in those cases to the kids.
You know, well,
they all do that.
They all do that. All right.
Yeah, but I mean, we're speaking out. Yes, there are internal problems, but they're also speaking out, ostensibly at least. I can remember around the State House a long time ago when I was a state senator, they surrounded the State House and saying, all about the kids. We know darn well it's about what they're getting paid.
Well, of course it is.
But I'm just saying that in this, I have struggled with this. I think it's very close. But I just look, it looks to me like just the discussion and saying, we ought to be calling the prosecutor because, hey, this is us, man. It's going to be affected. Now, I can understand saying if he called up and said, you know what, this is really going to mess up the way prisons are run and that this is something that the prosecutor is going to invade. And it's got to be an internal thing, control. Maybe he is looking at it as if he's looking at someone from the outside. But that's why I think it's a close question. That's why I ask about what is really the public concern he's trying to address.
And I certainly appreciate that, Judge Mannion. And I noticed that
I know your time's up. I want to ask you one question about the statute itself that prohibits cell phones going into prisons. Is it written? How is it written? I mean, it's probably in there. I didn't have time to find it.
Judge Kaney, I don't know that it is. I don't know that the statute specifically addresses the usage of cell phones.
Certainly you don't want inmates having cell phones. I mean, that's clear. But is it just broad in general so it encompasses anybody that, I mean, even visitors and so forth?
It does. I hate to misspeak on this, and I'm sure Ms. Welsh will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the gist of it is that there's got to be some intent element to bring contraband into the institution, or as opposed to a negligent mindset, which is what my client was operating under at the time, was that somebody was walking in negligently with a phone attached to him. They'd gotten out of their car, they walked in, and they didn't realize they had their phone. Facts later proved that wrong, that he was, in fact, using his telephone inside, and that clearly, him using his telephone inside of the institution violates Illinois law, all right? Because at that point, he has introduced contraband, electronic contraband, into the institution, and he knows he's done it because he's using it. So clearly, he has violated Illinois law at that point in time.
Well, your problem is Volkman's discipline, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's our issue, that Volkman was disciplined, and the question of whether there's a causal relationship, that's something that the district court has said is a tribal issue.
The statute did not exempt anybody.
No. I mean, we don't question. Cell phones are very dangerous for a prison. It creates a huge problem if you have inmates who have access.
Not the warden?
I believe the warden can. I think he actually testified that senior staff are allowed to have their cell phones.
By statute or by just...
Well, I don't know that I asked him that question.
Ask your opponent.
All right. Thank you all very much, and we would certainly request that this course reverse and remand the decision for a trial on the issue of causation. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welch. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, the Department of Corrections employees. To answer your question, Judge Kaney, the Illinois law prohibits knowingly possessing contraband, electronic contraband, which includes cell phones, in a prison. So it doesn't matter if you use it, although obviously the guy, Keir, who was being prosecuted, knew he had it with him because he made 20 or 30 phone calls. So accidental, and unless you have permission, and the warden can give you permission to possess it.
Statute does.
Well, the statute says without permission, and it's, the warden or, I assume the director or so could give you permission to have that. So here, again, what happened was that there was a prosecution of an incredibly serious security breach at the prison where plaintiff is a supervisor. And certainly as a supervisor, like all employees at a prison, your job encompasses security concerns. Part of your job is to ensure that the prisons are secure. So when when your job is to promote prison security and you tell a prosecutor not to prosecute a felony connected to security at your prison, your interest in expressing your personal disagreement about that prosecution is vastly outweighed by the department's interest in promoting security.
Mr. Volkman didn't have anything to do, however, with reporting that incident to a superior who then went to the prosecutor. How did that chain of command
Correct.
Work?
My understanding is that, and again, we're limited by, I'm limited as the court, I believe, is, since the transcript didn't show up until after the briefing. From this evidentiary hearing, as I understand it, there was an internal investigation. They discovered that Burkhardt, the other, the guard, possessed and used a phone in the prison to thwart an investigation. So, and according to its policy, that's stipulated. The parties agree that that is how it happened. And so what happens also is that the department's policy is when they discover that a crime has been committed in a prison, they refer that to the local prosecutor to determine whether to prosecute a case. So, but here, to the extent that this would be a close case, obviously defendants would have qualified immunity. That's precisely what qualified immunity is intended for, is to protect individuals in close cases. But to us and to the district court, to us, this really is not a close case at all. In fact, as the court suggested earlier, the department has a firm interest, an overriding interest in making sure that security breaches are punished, making sure that security breaches are deterred. This, and counsel just agreed, bringing a cell phone into a prison is a tremendous breach of security. It creates the potential for an inmate to intimidate a witness with a call, to order his colleagues to commit a crime. All sorts of consequences can flow from just having a cell phone in a prison.
I don't think we have any question about cell phones being a bad thing to have in prisons. I mean, there's all so many things.
Right, exactly. And the fact that, we have to look at the plaintiff's interest here. What was the plaintiff's interest? Because that's what we balance against the department's interest as the employer here. And what was plaintiff's interest? Plaintiff's interest was merely to express his personal disagreement with the prosecution of a felony that involves security at the prison where part of his job is to promote security.
Was that personal disagreement then something that you would label totally internal? It was based on how it affects him as an employee, as opposed to what the general issue is about somebody commenting about what might impact how a prison is run? I know that's sort of a double question, but
I'm not sure I understand.
I asked the same question. What what was his what was
public
the public
concern?
What was the comment? What was the comment on public concern? A matter of public concern.
Well, Your Honor, as we argued
in
our brief,
there wasn't any.
We don't think there was that he did speak on a matter of public concern right. In the Connick sense, because again, this was just his personal disagreement with the prosecution decision. He's never expressed what his public concern is.
Say his disagreement. His disagreement.
That's his personal disagreement
but
with the prosecution decision.
You can disagree for different reasons. Mm-hmm. He's disagreeing because of how, I guess it would be your position, how it affects the prison guards and what the internal discipline should be. And it should be confined inside the prison, et cetera, because otherwise it's bad for morale for the prison guards. We're not talking about... nobody's disagreeing about prisoners can't have cell phones.
Mm-hmm. He's never articulated any sort
of... Okay, well, that's what I was exploring.
Right.
What would be the public concern for a prison guard to call the prosecutor because of there's some external reason, at least the way mm-hmm. I label it, that this is not a good idea? An external reason means that this is going to be bad, you know, prosecutors are going to be trying to run prisons, and that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be some public concern that he did have. We don't know it. It's
okay,
never
you don't
been
think
articulated.
He expressed it, then.
No, because again, you know, as part of the matter of public concern Connick analysis, you ask, so what was his point? And what was the speaker's point in talking? And he's never articulated a public concern. It's always been, I disagree with that decision. That's the entirety of his point. And
well,
so,
I mean, I don't know if he has to say it. What, we would have to say it, the public. I suppose it seems to me what he's saying is that's too much of a penalty to impose. The guy got fired. Firing is not the issue. But criminally prosecuting somebody, which apparently he viewed as accidental, I mean, the guy brought the phone in accidentally, maybe too much.
Well, again, he didn't know. I mean, he admitted, I don't know, to the prosecutor, to the state's attorney, I don't know the facts here. And what he said was, it's quite interesting, apparently. I mean, he said, I told the prosecutor, if the guy gave the phone to the inmate, go ahead. If he didn't give the phone to the inmate, don't prosecute. And in fact, what he's saying is don't prosecute a felony, because just having the phone in your possession knowingly without permission is a felony.
Well, that's why I asked about exemptions for prison personnel, but apparently
I mean, there are exceptions if you have permission, but he doesn't have permission. And, you know, the General Assembly's decision, the public policy decision to make the knowing possession of a telephone in a prison is not the sort of thing that should be second-guessed by a person whose job is to promote security at the very prison where this felony occurred. And so this is the sort of problem. The department
well,
has
gone the other way around, though. If the General Assembly had said we're not going to pass any laws regarding cell phones in prisons, certainly would be permitted to speak out and say, no, that's a good idea to have it prohibited. I mean, I'm not sure I buy that argument
But again, you have to remember that when you're talking about, you know, prisons, you know, law enforcement is a special sort of employer. Prisons are even more special in terms of the amount of deference that needs to be given to their decisions and their testimony, as occurred here, about the disruptive effect of this sort of interference with the department's decision to refer the matter for prosecution, because again, this was a felony, not just a misdemeanor. It's a felony that happened at the very same prison. If the facts were different, if this were maybe a prison in another state, if he were not a supervisor, you know, if there were different facts, we would have a different case.
He wasn't concerned about his job, although he. I mean, was he? That wasn't Leister's.
He didn't suggest that, but I would imagine that anybody who knowingly possessed a phone in the prison would be a little concerned that they would be prosecuted. And so maybe this was a preemptive effect, you know, if he himself did this. But again, you know, there's, you know, every employer has the right to loyalty of its supervisors, and particularly with the employer's main mission, which again is security at the prison here. You know, this wasn't a complaint about food or about, you know, something tangential to his, you know, his job, prison food. This was about security at a prison.
Who was the official that actually referred the case? Was it the warden?
Oh, that's not in the record. We don't know. I mean, it's the department somehow would have referred it. And again, particularly in a paramilitary.
But that's what I'm saying. Hierarchically, if Volkman was his supervisor, the person that was fired and sought to be sued, if Volkman was in the chain of command, he didn't report it, or did he?
I believe not. I believe my understanding. I don't know this, but my understanding is that they weren't within the same chain of command.
They were not. Okay.
Right. But perhaps, you know, counsel knows better than I do about that.
We gave him more ace to
Right. But when, you know, when a person, a supervisor in a prison whose job is to support prison policy, including prison security policy, says stuff that contravenes that policy, you know, a prison has a right to discipline him. And again, you know, plaintiff wasn't fired. He got a written reprimand, which upon grieving it, he was able to, you know, compromise on. So, again, this is, you know, when you weigh the plaintiff's personal interest in just expressing his disagreement with the prosecution decision against the Department of Corrections' heavy interests in discipline of its people, in the loyalty of its supervisors, in not countenancing people who disagree with security policies at a prison, you know, it's no wonder that the district court here made the decision, balanced these two things, and said the department's interests outweigh the interests of the plaintiff in just personally disagreeing and expressing that personal disagreement.
And you can look at it, if it was, as you pointed out, it may not have been, Volkman may not, I mean, the person that was had the phone may not have worked for Volkman. But if he had to work for Volkman, and one of his people that worked for him was suddenly sued for a felony, there may be some basis that you're saying, well, that's not good for how things ought to operate under the circumstances.
Well, if the felony is connected to security?
Well, accidentally having a phone in, if you take the facts most favorable to him, just having a phone in, forgetting it, and then...
If he didn't know, then it wouldn't be knowing possession, and so he wouldn't have committed the felony.
Well,
right?
Knowing possession, I know he used the phone. That was the problem.
Right. I mean, this, you know, and the plaintiff didn't even know. You know, public, you know, matters, speaking out on matters of public concern is when you're, you know, speaking out, you know, not just a phone call to one person, when you're trying to expose official misconduct, when you're you know, whistleblowing, when you're doing things of that nature. And so, you know,
I don't think the test depends upon how widely the speech is disseminated.
No,
I
it
mean,
is
I think
not.
A single phone call to a state legislator.
Correct.
To a
absolutely.
State legislator might count.
Right. No, absolutely. Right. But I'm, you know, again, if you look at the you know, the to go back to our argument, which is that this doesn't even pass the Connick test.
I guess underlying this, and unfortunately we don't have that in a record, there's got to be more to it than just what we see, I think.
I mean, there may be, but then I do want to, in my last minutes, address what plaintiff was talking about in terms of the nature of the hearing. And it's, you know, as we explained in our brief, the predicate facts for the legal question of protected speech may be decided by the court. I mean, the court has to decide those predicate facts in order to determine, you know, it has to decide what is the plaintiff's interest, what is the defendant, what is the, you know, the employer's interest. It has to decide if you know, what the form and the content and the context of the speech are. It has to make a lot of factual determinations before a court can determine whether speech is protected in the first place. And those factual disputes must be decided by the district court in the first instance, and then the district court, you know, uses those factual disputes to apply the law, Connick, Pickering, Garcetti, all of these case law, to determine whether the speech is protected. We ask the court to affirm either on the merits or at the very least on the issue of qualified immunity. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.